a correct introduction. It's a controversial topic, and I have to say that sometimes I myself wonder, you know, does one really want to use clusters as cosmological probes? And so part of the reason for, you know, preparing this talk was we're working on the subject, and so, you know, a little bit of insight and background was in order. So let me start by a good place to start, which is the CMB experiments. You know, it was in 2003 that WMAP first put out its results, so just a little over a decade ago. And suddenly we went from, you know, uncertainties in cosmological parameters of few tens of percent, and in some cases, you know, as high as 100%, to roughly about 10%, and in some cases even sub-percent uncertainties. And that has all opened up this discussion of doing precision cosmology. Now, if you look at the WMAP website, they will claim that they were the ones who put precision in precision cosmology. But I think the definition of precision cosmology has changed considerably, and the drive now is to try and get these parameters, these cosmological parameters, down to sub-percent level. And the question is, why? You know, for somebody like me whose main bread and butter is to build cosmological models and study the formation and evolution of clusters of galaxies, knowing Omega Baryon down to, you know, 0.1% is sort of meaningless, given that there is so much astrophysics that's involved and there's so much uncertainty in modeling things like AGN feedback, that if we could get things right, even at a 10% level, we'd be really happy. So what is the, you know, what is the aim for having sub-percent precision in these parameters? Well, if you can nail these things down at sub-percent levels, especially in the regime that I will show you in a second, then it actually opens up a whole new window, an interesting window to look into inflation itself. Gives you a chance to probe inflation. It actually starts to allow you to look into the very nature of dark energy itself. And I will illustrate that in a second. So the microwave background experiments by themselves involve a whole host of parameters that go into trying to fit the power spectrum, for example. Now, some of these parameters are highly dependent on others, and some of them are often set so that when you look at the vanilla flavor model, you usually end up with a model of six parameters, and I've highlighted those six parameters, the generic ones at least. And part of this generic model is that there are some assumptions that are made in order to restrict the range of parameters that just wouldn't otherwise be well constrained. I'm talking about the equation of state for dark energy. In principle, you could have a W0 and a W1, which characterizes the evolution. In this case, the evolution parameter is ignored, and W0 is set to -1, so there is an equation of state. The running of the spectral index that comes out of inflation is set to 0 in the standard calculation. The neutrino mass is set to some low number like 0.06 EV, and the number of neutrinos are set to 3. And so with these kinds of constraints imposed, one goes ahead and tries to explore the parameter space associated with the remaining 6. And even then, we find that the parameters are highly correlated. So this is a result that I've stolen from a Planck paper, which shows you in a three-dimensional sense the correlated nature of the parameters. You have a high correlation between any two parameters, and in addition to that, there is a third variation in the Hubble parameter that's shown in the color bar here. And so clearly, we're not quite down at the 10%, at 1% or sub-percent level, just if you allow yourself flexibility of moving along any one of those bananas. We would like to cut that down. And it doesn't help that the two main CMB experiments around don't actually sit right on top of each other, that there is an offset between them, and that offset itself then allows for an uncertainty in the determination. And then again, there is a whole sort of variation that one needs to worry about. So the red curves up there show you the Planck results. The blue is the WMAP 9. I didn't bother plotting up the earlier WMAPs, but the Planck results, if you look at the light contour, which is marked Planck XX, that's the contour for in the sigma 8 omega matter plane. That's the contour that's actually published in their paper. If you redo their analysis and choose a different set of chains, you end up with this curve right here. And then if you include Planck plus lensing or Planck plus low L WMAP modes, you get a slightly different constraint. The main point is that just the variation between this one and that one is already something that needs to be understood. And in the absence of that, yeah.
What's made the degeneracy rotate in that reanalysis? Is that the Spiegel-Littell reanalysis?
That's the, it's actually done, it was sort of, yeah. So Spiegel was involved in this, but it was a reanalysis done by Pat Henry.
Rotated the degeneracy?
It has rotated, yeah, it has rotated. I mean, I don't know the details of this, but yes, Spiegel also has similar plots that show the similar kind of rotation.
By the way, we have a hockey stick if you want to point there.
I could imagine the thing shift, but rotating the whole direction seems.
I have seen CMB plots that have rotations, and even the ellipses themselves become rounder. I've seen a whole variation, and I have to say, you know, I haven't looked into the details of this per se, because basically the argument that I'd like to make is that at the end of the day, if you want to get down to precision cosmology, you do need a set of complementary probes, which will then start to cut down on your parameter space. So, you know, in this case, you're looking at W omega M. Here's your CM WMAP result. And then you have the baryon acoustic oscillation results, supernova results. And then there is two sets of cluster results. One is coming from cluster measurements at a particular epoch, which in this case is using the fraction of hot gas in clusters as a measure. The other is looking at cluster growth. And the combination of all that then allows us to start to break the degeneracy. And part of the reason is that the contours themselves are coming in at different directions and shutting down available parameter space. You can also do the same and start to look at, given that you are improving your precision now, you can now start to look at things like the evolution or the evolutionary nature of the dark energy itself. But then, if you're thinking about clusters, there is something that should give you pause. And that is shown by this particular plot, which is, again, from the Planck XX paper, where this is their standard CMB contour showing, again, omega matter sigma 8. And this is the result they get from the cluster count. So the Planck, apart from measuring the microwave background and doing the analysis on the microwave background to get the cosmological parameters, also detects clusters through the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And by looking at the counts of the clusters, and comparing it to theoretical models, you end up with a measure of what you would expect sigma 8 omega m to be. And this two results are inconsistent with each other at the 68% level. Now, this particular plot led Dick Bond at one of their, at the Planck meetings to argue that you would ignore clusters at your own peril. And there's a history behind this. Back in the day, most of you are too young to remember. There are a few faces here that might actually remember this. Back in the day, when I was a grad student, the model that was the standard model was the omega matter equals 1 H naught 50 cold dark matter, the so-called SCDM. And it was a beautiful model. Omega equals 1, very nice to work out. You can calculate things analytically. Theorists were loath to give it up. And observers, every time they went out and measured clusters, kept coming up with omega matter 0.3. And it took several years of consistent omega matter 0.3 results to keep coming up before theorists grudgingly gave up the standard model, the flat omega equals 1 model. And since then, I think there's a wary that when you have tensions like this, these tensions should be taken seriously because they could be suggesting something interesting that's going on. And so, you know, we have, and so this just highlights that tension where you have sigma 8 again represented in this combination, which is a combination it appears in from Planck, where the CMB result gives you a high value and the cluster result gives you a slightly lower result, and the two are in disagreement with each other. Yeah.
Probably quite a simple question. With clusters, are they actually measuring the amplitude of the power spectrum at 8 megaparsecs, or are they measuring it at many different scales?
I'll actually talk about that in a second. Yeah. So, you know, this tension between the clusters and the CMB has resulted in a slew of papers advocating potential solutions. And a paper by Wyman and can't remember the second author, but Wayne Hu is the last author on that. They argue that if you relax the basic assumptions, for example, that if you allow for an extra neutrino and you allow that extra neutrino to have a mass of 0.4 eV, so you introduce a sterile neutrino, that would actually resolve the problem. That's the original contours for the Planck. The red curves here are the contours that you get when you allow for this change. You also solve another tension, which I have not highlighted. If you look at the black curve here, that's a distribution for the Hubble parameter. The Planck Hubble parameter determination sort of goes from about 63 to 72. The cluster determinations tend to sit somewhere around 74. And those two are also discrepant with each other at the 3 sigma level. If you allow for this new model where you add an extra neutrino, you can resolve that particular tension as well. And so you have a possibility. I have a note there that, you know, you can also allow for running of the spectral index, which tells you something about the kind of inflation we have. And I have a note here about the BICEP2 result, which I guess I'm told is now again being debated, as we just learned downstairs. So you should ignore that note. But the point here is that, you know, good theorists can build reasonable models. And the question is, how do you cut down the available number of models, and, you know, how do you determine which is the model that nature has decided to follow? And in order to do that, one really has to ask, is this tension real? And so this is sort of letting the cat out of the bag. What I have done here is that in this very relatively busy plot, I have left on the Planck count. I have added on 3 other sigma 8m determinations, also from the clusters. This is the contour coming from the X-ray clusters that is described in.
Are there 60 are 95%.
These are 68%. From Pat Henry, there is another determination by Mans and company that puts you in this parameter space over here. And there is a third determination from Alexei Viklenin, which puts you in this zone right here. It's not surprising that that overlaps the Planck counts, because the Planck counts actually use this determination to calibrate the Compton Y parameter relationship. The main point here is that the fact that you have different determinations or different results coming from different cluster analysis should make you worried. It also indicates that this is not yet ripe for taking, you know, seriously at the percent level, for example. It's also not yet ripe for the purposes of speculating on what kind of models you would need to bring about concordance. Why are clusters useful cosmological probes? In the hierarchical picture that seems to be now well established, structures grow from small objects, and small objects then merge to form successively larger systems. In this picture, clusters of galaxies, which are represented here as bright yellow knots, form last. They are the most recent. They are the youngest objects to have formed. As this second movie illustrated, they are coming together at the present epoch. And so there is two aspects to the clusters that is actually directly amenable to observations. One is you can ask the question, what is the number of clusters of different masses that exist? So this coming back to the question that you asked. And then the second thing is, how rapidly are the number counts actually changing as a function of redshift? And both of these together provide a probe of the underlying cosmology. Now, I know most of the models here are not in vogue today, but I just wanted to use this to illustrate how the differences arise. So we're looking at here three sets of curves. They're going from redshift 0 back to redshift 1. The solid curves in each of the panels here represents the standard lambda universe. And the dashed lines represent different models. We have the standard cold dark matter, which was omega matter equals 1. And what you notice is that, first of all, the slope, so the shape at the high mass end, differs from that of the mass function that you get from lambda CDM. And then the growth is faster. So there's a higher evolution. You're increasing the number of clusters at a particular mass faster than you are in the lambda CDM universe, and the slope is different. If you go to the open CDM, which is omega matter 0.3, omega lambda equals 0, you see that the growth is slower in the OCDM model. The slope is about the same. You can take standard CDM and add a bump in the power spectrum and get a slightly different result, where the slope becomes the same, but the evolution then remains fast and, in fact, becomes slightly faster. Or you can take lambda CDM, and instead of using omega W equals minus 1, you can change the equation of state for dark energy to 0.8, and you find that there is a very, very slight difference. Certainly going from redshift 0 to redshift 1, this is a hint of what happens if you go to higher redshift. But at this redshift range, it's not significant, and the two models are essentially indistinguishable. But if you were to take the mass functions to higher redshift, you would start to see differences in the evolution. The problem with using clusters is that the plot that I showed you on the previous page is looking at the number of clusters as a function of mass, whereas we don't determine mass. And that is the crux of the whole problem. In trying to use clusters, we have to use an observable and map those observables over to mass. The kinds of observables available to us are temperature. And so there's the temperature function from Henry et al., which gave rise to that contour that I showed you earlier, where he was fitting the shape of the temperature function. You can look at the cluster luminosity function. These are, in effect, temperature functions or luminosity functions or number counts, if you will, at a particular epoch. And you can do this at different redshifts and look at the evolution in these functions as well. But you'd need to map temperature to mass, or you need to map luminosity to mass. You can look at number counts, not necessarily as a function of the of temperature or luminosity per se, but as a measure of the X-ray flux. And that gives you a curve something like this, which essentially means that as you go fainter and fainter, you're going further and further away and probing clusters at earlier times. And so this is something, the shape of this curve right here would build in evolution. And you see that here. The dashed curve is showing what you would expect if there was no evolution. And the cyan curve is showing you a case where there is some evolution. And to be honest, I can't remember what the level of evolution was built into this. But nonetheless, slight differences in these curves, if you have enough sensitivity, you'd be able to start to look to see whether there are evolutionary differences. You can do the same thing with the SZ counts. And so the SZ has an advantage that the selection effect essentially remains flat once you get up to about redshift of 1 all the way out to higher redshifts. And this is a prediction of what you would expect from Planck for the standard model. And this is a prediction you would expect for something that has a greater sensitivity, for example, SPT, where the mass threshold is drops down to about 10 to the 14. So whereas the Planck clusters, Planck is sensitive to clusters at around 10 to the 15 solar mass range, SPT experiments can probe clusters that are about a factor 10 smaller in mass. And therefore, you are probing a slightly different part of the mass function and getting more objects. And you can see what you can start to do at higher redshifts. The number counts, for example, here, this is a standard lambda CDM universe, except the only thing that's changing is that the W parameter has changed. And you can see that at redshifts 1 and greater, you can start to see deviations. And those deviations allow you to start to probe the equation of state of dark energy. If life was this simple. The problem is, baryon physics can mimic effects like this. And so evolution in the state of the gas, whether the gas is being heated or not, for example, and we know that clusters of galaxies have at their centers very powerful AGNs that are driving very strong winds and jets into the intracluster medium. And the effects, those AGNs have been around since redshift of 2 or 3 when galaxies started to form, and that they've been active since then. And so one of the questions is, what is the impact of the AGNs on the gas that eventually accumulates into clusters of galaxies? Are you throwing in cold gas into the clusters of galaxies, cold gas gets shock heated and you get your standard model of clusters, or are you throwing in gas that has already been heated up by the AGNs? And so when they fall in, they are not, they have a slightly different thermodynamic characteristics. And so they behave somewhat differently. They settle into a slightly different equilibrium state. And when you then look at the predictions for number counts, you get a suppression in the numbers. To understand why this is happening, let me just show you what clusters today look like. What I am plotting here as a function of radius is something called the entropy parameter. The entropy parameter is a proxy. It's defined up here. It has a relationship to the thermodynamic entropy of the gas, but in the form that's easily measurable. So temperature and number density of the electrons is something that you can directly get from observations. And so this particular ratio is essentially being shown here. And what you see is that at large radii, most of the clusters sit on top of each other. In other words, they behave very much like each other. If you scale the clusters for the fact that they are different masses, this scatter will essentially collapse to have all the objects virtually sit on top of each other. The problem is, in the center of the clusters, there's this huge variation, which is telling you that the clusters are being heated to different degrees. Some of the cluster centers are hot, some of them are cold, and in literature, these systems are often described as cool core and non-cool core clusters, just to give you some broad categories. The gamma here that's used is just 5/3 for regular ideal gas. And the effects of that kind of a heated floor in the gas essentially has the following significance for the SZE measurements. So if you have a very massive clusters and you have gas that has entropy, I apologize for changing variables on you, but S here is the same thing as K. I missed this when I was stealing slides from a different talk. But basically, when you have the entropy parameter going from 10 all the way up to 500, and just to show you what I mean by that, 10 is down here, so I'm looking at clusters that would have shapes that look like this, whereas 500 are objects up here, and everything else is spread out in between. When I do that, the most massive clusters don't seem to get affected very much, except in the very centers. And so certainly the bulk of the cluster body, which basically sits to the right of -1 here, is not being affected very much. But as you go down to smaller and smaller clusters, particularly at 10 to the below 10 to the 14, you start to see that the central gas distribution is much flatter, and there starts to be gas being pushed outside what you would call the virial radius of the cluster, and it creates a higher density of gas, which then leads to a signal coming from the larger regions. And this is a plot of the pressure in the clusters. This is what you would expect for the Compton Y parameter. And you can see, again, exactly in the same way, the Compton Y parameter at large radii in the most massive clusters is not being affected very much. But as you go to lower masses, this is starting to make a difference. Now, I say to you that yeah.
There's a kind of an uncertainty introducing the scatter between clusters. And is this going to give you some kind of Malmquist bias in your mapping? Is that where you're going?
So it's not giving you necessarily a Malmquist bias, but it starts to create confusion in the sky maps.
Right.
It also leads to a suppression of power. So, for example, if you're measuring, the CMB Compton parameter is measured within R500. So you're measuring things within this radius. You're integrating the Compton value inside of this. up here, you see what you see is that the Compton Y parameter that you would measure for a system with 10 to the 13 solar masses is now lower.
Okay, so it's not a scattering what you're inferring about a given system. You still know what's going on in the given system.
That's right. Okay. That's right. You're trying to take a observed number counts and compare it to a theoretical model. You're taking a mass function and you're trying to convert the mass into a Compton number.
It's a luminosity function that does introduce a Marcus bias.
But that can be corrected out.
Right.
Right.
But this isn't.
No, this isn't, yeah.
Okay.
But it does introduce confusion in the sense that this is a simulated sky map of what groups and clusters would look like if you had low entropies. And what you have when you have high entropies, you can see things have become fuzzier. And while the large systems remain more or less well-defined, the smaller systems that are now in projection are not tend to be much more extended. And so you are now starting to pick up signals from nearby objects that are overlapping. So that is where this kind of effect starts to come into play. Another example of redshift evolution is shown by this. This is an illustrative case. I am not entirely sure about the data yet. I've seen cases where temperature functions don't seem to evolve versus temperature functions that are evolving dramatically. And this is one example of a temperature function that that the claim is that it's evolving strongly. But nonetheless, it serves the purpose that I want to use it for. So without commenting on the validity of the observations or the claims in the paper, let me just use it for what the purpose that I need it. You have blue curve showing you what the redshift 0.05 number counts in temperature should be. You can calculate if you had no evolution in temperature what you would expect at redshift 0.5, and that's the golden solid curve here. If you allow the temperatures to evolve, in other words, the mapping between mass and temperature at lower redshift and the mapping between mass and temperature at high redshift has changed, and it's changed in this fashion so that you can explain the counts as shown here. You go from over here to the dashed solid, the dashed golden line. The results in the Compton in the number counts that you would get from experiments like Planck, for example, are shown right here. That it does exactly the same thing that you had. The golden results are showing the no evolution. And when you allow for temperature evolution of the kind that I illustrated in the previous slide, you get similar kinds of drops in number counts. And just to remind you, these features of dropping at redshift 1 mimic the kinds of changes you would expect if there was no evolution and all you're trying to do is plot probe for the omega W parameter. So trying to get cosmology really does mean trying to get the astrophysics of clusters right. Now, I'm not going to discuss very much about the astrophysics in clusters, although that's my primary area of study, because we've been doing something different. I mentioned to you that in addition to the astrophysics, trying to get a mapping between an observable and a mass measurement, or the mass itself, is also important. And we've been doing that over the last year and a half. And we're starting to get close to some interesting results. And while I can show you some of our early results, what I'd also like to do is highlight all the nuances that go into that. Because that sort of feeds back to whether you want to introduce extra neutrinos and whatnot at this point in the game. Before I continue on, just to finish off from what I was describing, this is the green curve here shows you the number counts that you would expect from Planck just using the standard parameters that you get from the CMB. And this is what you get from when you actually do the Planck SZ counts. And now the question you could ask is that reduction astrophysics? Is it cosmologic? Is it telling you something about cosmological parameters? Or is it telling you something completely different? And it's the completely different bit that I'd like to focus on. So about 6 years ago, we started a campaign called the Canadian Cluster Comparison Project, which we have, which we call CCCP. And one of my colleagues, this Hank Hoekstra, in a classic Hoekstra-esque statement, came up with a slogan: "It's good for the masses." And that's exactly why we chose this particular set of clusters. Generally speaking, when people study clusters, they try and construct a cluster sample that is flux limited or volume limited. We decided that what we wanted was a set of clusters that we could get very good mass estimates for using weak lensing, but we could also get very good observable parameters in the X-ray, and that they would be on target lists of SZ experiments. And we also, at the same time, wanted clusters that tended to be sampling a scatter in this particular relationship, the temperature-luminosity relationship. And the reason for choosing to sample the scatter in the temperature-luminosity relationship is the following. From the work that we've been doing for the past decade, we know that the scatter here is not random. At a given temperature, clusters have a variation in luminosity of about a factor of 10, and that scatter is not random. If you remember the plot I just showed you earlier, where you have an entropy, clusters with low central entropies tend to have cooler gas, which then concentrate more, and they shine tremendously in the center. So they have a very bright central cores. They also have cool gas, because that's why they have low entropy. They tend to sit on the upper edge of this relationship. On the other hand, clusters that are heated tend to have their gas concentrations in the center depressed. X-ray luminosity scales as density squared. So dropping the density drops their luminosity. And so you end up with clusters that tend to sit at the other end of this particular plot. So by being able to sample the scatter, we actually have clusters that are both cool core and non-cool core. And now we can start to break apart, tease apart differences between these two types. We go one step further. Clusters that are disturbed, in other words, when you smash two clusters together and they are out of hydrostatic equilibrium, their gas distribution swirls around, they can move up and down this plot. And we also wanted to be able to sample clusters that are in the state of merging, because when SZ does its survey, now we know SZ has a bias towards clusters that are merging, but generally speaking, when Planck does its survey, or SPT do their surveys, or even large X-ray surveys are done, there isn't enough photons to go and look at each one of the clusters in detail and see whether it's a merging cluster or not a merging cluster and then throw it out, to determine whether it's a cool core cluster or not a cool core cluster and throw it up. You just have a large sample and you want to treat this sample. What you don't want is a sample that is biased in a certain way, and then you choose your analysis method and it turns out that that analysis method itself is biased and sensitive and gives you results that can lead you astray. So we had a very deliberate choice of doing something different from what everybody else was doing. The characteristics of our sample are described right there. I'm not going to go through it. And I'm happy to talk to anybody who's interested in the CCCP sample. So basically, one of the things that we wanted to do with the CCCP sample is to determine the masses using weak gravitational lensing. So there we have a cluster. We have background galaxies. On the backside of this cube, you see what the galaxies would look like in the sky if the cluster was not there. And you have your orientations of galaxies any which way. In the foreground, if you had a cluster in the foreground, the galaxies, the beams from the galaxies would basically propagate forwards. And as they pass this high concentration, they get sheared. And you basically have a map where the galaxy orientation start to take on more of a tangential look to them. And this is what you expect. This is what you end up getting. This is a exquisite HST image of a cluster of galaxies. The red galaxies are the galaxies that are actually in the cluster itself. The blue galaxies are the are preferentially background galaxies. And if you look carefully, you can start to see a swirl.
By red galaxies, you mean yellow galaxies.
The golden, yes, yellow, yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm not talking about these guys. You're right. The blue galaxies, if you notice that they are arranged so that they are distorted, they are sheared in a tangential direction. And this is a map that shows that a little bit more clearly. It's a numerical simulation of what you would expect lensing to do. The dashes show you the major axis orientation of the galaxy images, and you can see the swirling patterns. And you can use these swirling patterns essentially to measure gravity and in turn get a direct probe of the of at least the two-dimensional mass. Now, to turn a two-dimensional mass into a three-dimensional mass, we do need to make an assumption. We assume that the halo is a spherical NFW halo with the parameters shown here. And I note that this introduces a model dependence, but this model dependence, again, can be rigorously tested because in numerical simulations, you have the ground truth. You know what clusters look like. These are numerical simulations. Clusters come in all sorts of triaxial shapes. You can test to see what kind of uncertainties and variations you end up with. And this kind of modeling, in the ideal case, leads to about a 5% variation in recovered mass. So this is good. If we can get it down to 5%, we'd be very happy. And now the question is, what mass, what observable proxy can we use? We have a sample. We can determine their masses to within 5%. And we have X-ray observations. So we can start to look at the relationship between different observable proxies and the mass. What time did I start? That's off. That's off, yeah.
I think you have
5 minutes?
About 15 minutes.
15.
You have half 15 minutes.
Okay, all right. So the standard one that often is quoted is temperature. And what I'd like to emphasize using this plot is, first of all, if you look at just the results, forget about the blue and the red colors and look straight at the entire fit, you see that the scatter, the intrinsic scatter in this particular proxy is 46%. What that's telling you is that at a fixed temperature, there is a 46 plus or minus 14% scatter in the mass estimate. That's large. That's not what you want if you want to do precision cosmology. So temperature is not good. Now, I'm going to highlight something. In this case, we're making a cut at a particular radius. So we're choosing a R500, a particular radius within which the overdensity is 500 times the critical. But it's 500 times the critical based on the mass profile that we get from lensing. You can do this the other way. You can calculate what the mass should be based on X-ray and make a cut at R500 based on the X-ray data, and you get a much nicer plot. The plot has a scatter of 21%, which is actually pretty good. This is it's getting down to the best case scatter you can get to. Problem is
that the intrinsic scatter or the total?
That's the intrinsic scatter. The problem is, notice the shape is pretty good. In fact, the theoretical relationship you'd expect between mass and temperature is 1.5. So the slope looks really good. This one, you know, 1.9. This is wrong. It's wrong because, apart from the fact that the slope is correct, and I can describe this if anybody's interested. Well, if you're interested, ask me the question. But the main reason for this being wrong is that this slope is not a real slope in the sense that it's not measuring the real relationship between temperature and mass, but rather the two quantities are very strongly correlated in the sense that because I'm using X-ray data to get the temperature and I'm using X-ray data also to make a cut on the mass, I'm introducing a correlation in these relationships, and the correlations are ellipsoidal, very long ellipsoids, and they tend to sit oriented in this plane at 1.5. So I am scattering all the data into a narrow ellipse that has a slope of 1.5. I am measuring the slope of the error correlation, and I'm getting very narrow scatter in this direction, 21%, for that reason. Worry number one. You got to test for the cross correlations between the parameters you're using. They better be the correlation between your observable and your mass better be absolutely weak, preferably not existent. Otherwise, you get all sorts of problems to worry about.
So I guess then your error bars are kind of wrong. You have to rotate your error bars by some degree.
Yes, that's right. The triangles here are splitting between the central entropy. Cool entropy is blue, high entropy is red. Here the circles are splitting between a parameter that we're using to determine whether this cluster is relaxed or not. Blue are relaxed, red are not. You can see generally the scatter is large, and it's not really worth discussing temperature any further. Well, basically, the measurement here, the D parameter, is we tried a whole host of ways to determine the relaxed state, whether the cluster was in hydrostatic relaxed or it was dynamically relaxed also, right? And there are several different measures one can apply. This one turned out to be just as good, and it's very simple. It's just looking at the offset between the BCG and the X-ray peak. If the X-ray peak and the BCG happen to sit on top of each other, the largest galaxy in the system. So if the largest galaxy in the system happens to sit at the bottom of the potential, the X-ray peak and the galaxy would basically sit on top of each other, you would be blue. If there is an offset between them and the offset is large, larger than 0.1, you know, larger than 10 kiloparsecs, then we consider it to be unrelaxed. For our purpose. The other one measure that people often use is hydrostatic mass itself. You have X-ray measurements. You can calculate the mass using assumptions of hydrostatic equilibrium. You can compare that to the weak lensing masses. The other plot was log-log. This is linear plot. So if the scales look different, I caution you about that. The main thing here is that the scatter is relatively small. The problem is that there is a systematic bias at play here, and it's basically summarized by this plot. So looking at clusters that are cool core versus non-cool core, we find that cool core clusters, the hydrostatic mass and the weak lensing mass agree fairly well, but non-cool core clusters, tend to underestimate the mass systematically, no matter where you are doing the measuring in the cluster, whether you do it at R2500, R1000, or R500. This systematic variation is worrisome. So if you have a sample that somehow gets skewed because of the way you've selected your sample into having a preponderance of non-cool core clusters, you will then start to underestimate the masses. And so that's something that you want to be cautious about. I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to talk about luminosity.
Can I just ask, is this X-ray hydrostatic component, is that one rotation curve?
No, that's by taking the, it's by looking at, so the X-ray emission gives you the distribution of gas. The X-ray measurements also give you a temperature profile for the gas, so it requires you to have enough data, enough photons to be able to measure the, and a spectra, to be able to get an estimate of the temperature. And then you just ask, you just argue that the gas is in hydrostatic equilibrium in the potential, right? So you're not looking at the rotation, you're not looking at any objects. The dynamical, that's another measure of mass, which is a dynamical measure where you look at the motions of galaxies inside the cluster. That's extremely noisy. So generally for mass proxies, we don't use that one. Gas mass turns out to be a very good way of estimating the true mass of the cluster. This is gas mass within R500 weak lensing. And you can see that it has an excellent scatter up here. And also suggests that there is there's a universal gas mass estimate, at least for large clusters. Now, problem here is that there is a very, very weak correlation between the radius at which we're measuring the gas mass and the gas mass itself. And so just to break that degeneracy, we decided to look at gas mass within a fixed aperture. You pick your aperture of 1 megaparsec, you measure the gas mass within that using X-rays. You can do this just using surface brightness profiles, because the temperature does not enters into the estimate of gas mass very weakly. So you don't need spectroscopy, you just need surface brightness profiles. It's actually very good for surveys. And the weak lensing mass within the same aperture, again, an extremely tight relationship, 16% scatter. This is one of our better proxies that we were able to identify. There is a slight variation between relaxed and non-relaxed clusters, or between cool core and non-cool core, but it's manageable. The differences are relatively small. And generally speaking, we would argue that this is actually a fairly decent mass proxy. And there are not, you know, so the first thing that's coming out of our work is that not all mass proxies are equal. And in fact, some of these unusual ones, like the gas mass, is turning out to be much more sensitive mass proxy. We can look at something called the pseudo pressure, which Andrei Kratsov has introduced. It is basically a product of gas mass and temperature, and it's comparable in some sense to the Compton Y parameter. And that is absolutely the best X-ray mass proxy that we can identify. It has a fairly low scatter, and it seems to show very little ability to distinguish between cool cores and non-cool cores and dynamical versus non-dynamical. In other words, it's extremely insensitive to this. And that's exactly what you want for a survey. You take a big survey, you have hundreds of clusters. You really don't want to sit there and split your samples apart and divide and break down your statistics. This thing will allow you to do that. So in principle, this is extremely good.
So you need the temperature for that one?
You need an integrated temperature. So yeah, you do need a temperature, but you need an integrated temperature.
Question, what happened to cool core versus non-cool core? Do you have it here? You don't relax.
No, here it is. This.
Ah, okay. So left is. I see. So there isn't much difference.
There isn't much difference. This one is really insensitive. Mm-hmm. The only trick is, and I think the cautionary note is that we're doing it within 1 megaparsec, so it's a fixed aperture. If you bring this in and do it relative to the density, scatter jumps up to about 30%. So where you choose, how you choose to use this proxy also becomes important. Planck. So let me finish off with this very quickly. This is the Planck parameter, weak lensing. The same two plots that I've been showing here, cool core, non-cool core, here, relaxed, non-relaxed. This is, you know, compared to YX, the plot that I showed you before, this is not as good. But mind you, it is also being calculated at R500. So there is a little bit of a degeneracy. If you could go back and redo the Planck at fixed aperture, you'd probably get a tighter correlation. But that's not what I would like to emphasize, is that in spite of the fact that it has some deficiencies, it's sensitive to dynamical measurements, it's sensitive to cool core or non-cool core in some weak sense, it has the advantage in the sense that you could actually look at clusters at high redshifts. And so you can start to get number counts and probe this regime where we describe, where I showed you cosmology starts to become interesting. So then the question is, given what we have, are we ready to do precision cosmology? Well, we still have this problem. Okay, we identified a mass proxy. We still don't know what's going on here as to why these different clusters are cluster constraints are so far off from each other. And so I would say we're not there yet, but we're getting there. And I would say that within the next year, things are going to change dramatically. And the reason they're going to change dramatically is the following. We know where the problem is coming from. This is the, I've now flipped this plot because this is how everybody else plots it. This is the Planck. This is the weak lensing masses. The red curve is the result that I've been showing you. This is the Planck result. You notice that it's slightly skewed compared, slightly off in terms of its slope, but more or less the normalization is right. But the slope, the change in slope, the fact that you, that the Planck, I would argue, tends to underestimate masses at the low mass end and overestimate the masses at the high mass end, that is enough to move their curves around, their sigma 8m relationship. That's right, their calibration. That's what I'm plotting
this
here.
It's within 1 sigma of yours. The slot is 1.79 is within 1 sigma.
Of yeah, it is within 1 sigma of ours, yeah.
So it
could be right. This is weigh the galaxies. So there's another group, WTG, weigh the giants, who's come out with, very recently came out with their own calibration and compared it to Planck. And that's their result. And now you can see that that is off. And they claim that they so their mass estimates at 10 to the 15, for example, is something like they claim that Planck is underestimating the masses by at 0.68 of their value. That's a significant number because it's no longer just 10% differences. We're now talking about 40% differences. And there we can start to break this problem down. This problem is soluble. And it's soluble because we know how to go about trying to address it. And I've just listed some things of what could be potentially at play. But the reason we can break it down is that we know how lensing works. We can take a simulated galaxy cluster. In other words, we can take ground truth again, where we know what the real mass is. We can do the lensing. And the important thing about simulating the images that, go into the lensing is that we can create mock galaxy distributions. What you do need to do this right is you need to have the correct number counts in your background galaxy. You need to have your appropriate ellipticity distributions. You need to make sure your redshift distribution is correct. Once you have your lensed image, you need to add the right noise level that is relevant to the observations that you're looking at. In other words, you can't just take a vanilla-flavored simulation of mock galaxies, compare it, get a mass estimate, and say, this is about 20% error. You have to do exactly what you do. That includes using identical pipeline. And I'll show you very quickly before I stop how all of this plays out. Weak lensing folks, for the most part, started out using this number count as a model for testing their simulations. These were used in the large scale measurements of weak lensing. They were also used for clusters. The blue bars are showing you the regime for CCCP. Notice that we are missing all these faint galaxies. That makes a difference. And so we can now put in, we've been using a much more robust and correct a number count distribution to recalibrate the CCCP masses. And so I've shown that up there. I'm not going to go into details. Input ellipticity. When you look at Hubble observations, you get series of input ellipticities. Galaxies are not round. They have an elliptical shape. The original simulation that everybody has been calibrating against has a very, very different and completely non-realistic ellipticity distribution. You got to put in what real galaxies look like in order to figure out exactly what the answers you get out. But even then, it turns out it's not as trivial as that. So here, we're comparing the CCCP ellipticities, the underlying ellipticities that we would need to introduce. This is what we are getting from HST and GEM, particularly GEMS-like surveys, that the original underlying ellipticity should be characterized by this parameter 0.35. We find that we need an original ellipticity that's, first of all, dependent on the magnitude of the galaxies. Bright galaxies seem to be more consistent with 0.15. Faint galaxies are closer to the underlying. What's happening? The software you use to fit the ellipticity plays a role. So how you calculate the ellipticity and exactly what software you use makes a difference. GalFit gives a greater weight to the outer regions of the galaxies. And that's what's changing our underlying original input ellipticity from 0.35 to 0.15. These look like nitty, now it looks like I'm digging into the nitty-gritty dirt now. But if you want to get to 10% in mass, you got to do this. And that's what we've been doing for the last few months. The final thing, and this is actually is the biggest source of error, we were using redshift distribution from the CFHT LS deep fields within this range, and that is shown by the red dashed line right here. Okay? There is now a newer, better redshift distribution available, Cosmos Ultra Vista, and that's shown here in blue. At first level, it looks like they're identical. If you look really carefully, you find that the red has slightly more galaxies at redshifts greater than one. And the effect of that is right here. This beta parameter is what goes into the mass calculation. It's the ratio of the angular diameter distances. And for the red curve, beta is high. If you use the Cosmos field, you drop down by 10%. That's a systematic 10%. That's a bias in the mass measurements.
It's much more than 10%.
Well, beta enters into mass, so it's a 10% in mass.
Most of the data is faint. Which variable that this direction was spent? Right, okay.
So the takeaway is that, in principle, all of these problems can go away. There are at least four groups out there doing this. Ourselves, the Locus group, of which I'm also part of, Clash, of which Andy Madavi is part of, and Weigh the Giants, which none of us are part of. Now, we haven't actually, we try and create a wall between us so that there is no, there's no contamination of results. And the analysis is done completely blindly by different groups of people. So It's Hank Hoekstra doing it here and not talking to anybody else. There is a, do you remember his name, Nobu?
Oh,
James is also part of Locus. Anyways, there's a Japanese collaborator who's doing this. Okabe. I'm not sure who's doing it in Clash. This is the Stanford group that's doing it down here. Wanda Linden is the lead author. And there are multiple common clusters between these groups. And what we've been doing is that, having gone through the entire analysis of the pipeline that we have gone through, we're now finding that the common clusters between CCCP and Clash are agreeing to within 10% in our masses. So the first thing actually is to, you have a common set of clusters, you better get the same masses. And at least two of the groups are starting to converge. We'll see what happens. There's a meeting in Paris in the summertime where we'll find out what the rest of the field is doing. So I will basically stop there with one caveat. You can say, okay, if you manage to get this done at lower redshifts, can you redo this at higher redshifts? Because clearly there's evolution to worry about. And the answer is not really. That's because, remember, we have 50 clusters. Locus has about 50 clusters. Way the galaxies have about 30 clusters. With small overlaps, you know, 10 or 20. But basically, the total ensemble of clusters that everybody's working on to beat this thing down is roughly about 100. We have all the clusters that are available in the local universe to do this, and we're still having difficulties getting this right. To redo this at higher redshifts, I'm not convinced that that's likely. And so that is where the other stuff that I'm doing starts to play, where we're basically doing simulation studies where we build on different types of physics into these things and try to get a fully holistic modeling of galaxy clusters and groups. And by holistic, I mean that unlike previous attempts where you try and get the hot gas right and ignore the galaxies, or you try and get the galaxies right and ignore the hot gas, or you try and get the central AGN right and forget about other things, we're actually doing the whole shebang. Groups, clusters, galaxies, intracluster medium. The idea is that all of these constraints are basically limiting the kind of physics you can put in. And we've been making considerable progress, so hopefully in about a year's time, I'll come back and give you a talk on that. Thank you. In the amplitude. I don't know yet. We know that, so what we've done is.
Are they using lensing or is it a different method to do the weighing?
No, they're using lensing. And what's interesting is that they have six clusters that are in the same with us. So that's why I put this up. I didn't actually get a chance to mention it. I talked about the uncertainties in the weak lensing. That I can address. They have about six clusters that overlap with us. And when we do one-on-one comparison, we find that we're within, I think it was 15% of their masses. So we're not that far off.
With a systematic shift or not?
There is a systematic shift, but the systematic shift is much smaller than what you see here. What's coming into play here and what I don't know is that their sample, so right, we're fitting the entire sample here to get our relationship. If I start to throw away lower mass clusters, I start to flatten these things. The slope starts to flatten. So we don't know. I have not looked into their sample selection carefully enough. So their range of clusters and their mass will make a difference. If I restrict our CCCP galaxies to within this range and refit the slope, it changes. So how have they chosen their clusters and whether they have a representative sample sort of makes a difference at this point. And we haven't had a chance to actually debug it because we're still trying to as I said, pin down the uncertainties in our masses. But this is worrisome. The only saving grace here is that the Wicklennan results on which the Planck is based on and the clash, you know, there's variations with CCCP and or there's variations between CCCP and Planck and clash, but those variations we can understand as uncertainties in the mass measurements themselves, the determinations. Where the galaxies really are off at this point. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, I've heard many times that if you excise the cool core, you then reduce the scatter in the X-ray. Is that something where you need higher resolution data to do that with, say, the CCCP sample? Or?
No, so in fact, the curves that I showed you, where I used, I didn't discuss the luminosity one, but I did discuss the temperature one. Both the luminosity and the temperature that we use are core cut.
Okay.
So we actually have enough photons that we can cut out. And yes, the scatter goes way up if you leave the core in. And the correlation with the cool core, non-cool core is there. So if you looked at the luminosity plot, I didn't show you. I can show it to you later. But if you looked at the luminosity, you would find that there's very little in terms of a correlated differences between cool core and non-cool core. That's because the core was cut out. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I have a quick question. So you said that, I think I got this right, you said that this gets harder as you go to higher redshift. So first of all, is that because this is a kind of statistics-based method of weighing things, like fitting slopes and such? And does that mean that, like, it's impossible when we go to really high redshift to really know the mass of things? So, like, say JWST has like a galaxy at redshift 13, you know, you can't know the mass of that.
No, sorry, what gets hot? Can you?
Were you saying that this method of weighing clusters, you can't do it as you go to higher redshift, where it gets harder?
It gets harder, yeah. Well, this particular method can, yeah. No, it's because
enough points to calibrate it.
Yes, that's basically it. That there are fewer clusters at higher redshifts. And if you're doing a survey mode, what you're doing is you're trying to get a big sample and you're trying to avoid having to do the detailed analysis of the kind that you're doing here.
And that means that you can't use this method if you're just talking about one galaxy at redshift.
We wouldn't use weak lensing to do galaxies. Right. The reason we can get away with clusters is because they're so massive that you can get a large number of background objects that are being sheared by the same system, right? That's also a big part of the play. The one reason why we need 50 to 100 clusters at low redshift is that weak lensing is noisy way of estimating mass. So you need a large number of samples to beat it down. And then you need a very large number of background galaxies to get mass estimate for one cluster. So for galaxies, what people like Mike have been doing, that you stack galaxies. Or you stack, even for groups, you can't do this very easily. You need to stack groups. So for galaxies like that, I think there would have to be different ways of getting at the mass estimates. You look at stellar mass, for example. In galaxies, stellar mass tends to be fairly well correlated with the dark matter halos.
Any more questions? So before we thank Arif again, two notices. Firstly, as usual, we'll be going to dinner with Arif at 6 p.m. in the bistro, and postdocs and students will be covered. And then the second announcement is that we have, again, as usual, the Journal Club today at 3:30 p.m. in here. If you haven't registered already, the papers that we wrote for to discuss are on Vox Charter. And we will discuss a paper or two. So let's thank Arif again.